Welcome to the deep dive. So you've brought us a really fascinating stack of sources today. It's all centered on the visual history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
That's right. Specifically, the paintings of a BYU professor, Anthony Sweat.
And our mission for this deep dive is to analyze how this institutionally aligned art acts as a kind of silent acknowledgement, an acknowledgement of major historical issues that critics, maybe most famously the CES letter, were really attacked for bringing up just a few years ago.
It's a remarkable study in delayed transparency. I mean, the core contradiction our sources lay out is this. For decades, if you mention certain facts like Joseph Smith using a seer stone in a hat.
Or his legal troubles.
Exactly. You could be disciplined, sometimes even excommunicated. And yet now, through this art, those exact details are being visually, well, conceded by the institution itself.
So we're going to unpack eight of these flashpoints, eight places where the official visual record has now shifted, essentially proving that critics weren't making things up.
They were just telling the truth. A bit too early for the institution's comfort.
Okay, let's get into this visual concession. The timeline is so critical here. Before we jump into the 8 points, who is the man behind the canvas? Anthony Sweat.
He's the department chair of church history and doctrine at BYU.
Which sounds very official. But you pointed out a surprising detail in his background. He has a BFA in painting. And his PhD is in curriculum and instruction, not history.
Right. And that's key. He's an educator and an artist, used to work for seminary and institutes. So he's an expert in visual communication, in curriculum design.
So his stated goal, to center on previously unrepresented important aspects of church history, is really about teaching.
It is. But you have to understand, this is not some spontaneous act of transparency. This art is a reaction.
It's visual damage control.
In a way, yes, because the push for this kind of historical honesty started long before 2014, which is when Sweat really began this body of work.
Okay, so let's set that stage. What's the historical arc here?
It's long. You have to go back to 2002 with Grant Palmer's book, An Insider's View of Mormon Origins. It laid out so many of these issues and led directly to his disfellowshipping.
Then a year later, 2003, the South Tark episode.
Famously accurate, it gave millions of people their first visual of Joseph translating with his head in a hat, a detail the church had, you know, vigorously denied for generations.
And for anyone who was really deep in this online, there was that anonymous website, Images of the Restoration, around 2007, 2008.
Yes. That site was already showing all of this. The divining rods, the multiple first vision accounts, even things like drinking at Carthage Jail. The critics were illustrating the truth long before the institution was.
So when Jeremy Reynolds publishes the CES letter in April 2013, it just synthesizes everything. It goes viral.
And the institution is suddenly under immense pressure. So Sweat's artwork, starting in 2014, it's impossible to see it outside of that context. The timing isn't an accident. It's the official visual response.
That sets the stage perfectly. Okay, let's dive into these 8 points of validation, starting with translation and, well, a lot of hidden history.
Let's start with the big one, the one that trips up so many members when they first find out about it. The multiple first vision accounts.
Right. Point one. Sweat's painting is called the First Visions, plural. And it's trying to combine elements from all the different versions. You see an axe, a pillar of light, a devil figure.
Multiple angels, God and Christ may be appearing separately. It's this collage-like effort.
Critics call it harmonization, right?
Exactly. Instead of actually dealing with the contradictions, like, was the main point forgiveness for sins, like in the 1832 account? Or was it to find out which church to join from the 1838 version?
The painting just sort of visually crams it all into one scene.
Which lets the institution say, see, we're being transparent, all the details are here, without ever having to explain why the accounts are so different. Or why that 1832 account was literally ripped out of a letter book and hidden for years.
And the CES letter claim was just about that basic knowledge, that people just didn't know there were multiple contradictory accounts.
And that ignorance was actively maintained. You remember that clip of Elders Oaks and Ballard where they claimed the church wasn't hiding anything?
Yeah. They cited a single, obscure Ensign article from 1970.
An article that was incredibly hard to find. It certainly wasn't front and center on the church's website. So the art, by its very complexity, confirms the history that was suppressed.
Okay, moving to point two. This connects that story to folk magic, the seer stone, treasure digging, and all the legal trouble.
So Sweat's painting, Gazam, a stone, shows Joseph finding his brown seer stone in 1822, while digging a well for Willard Chase.
And this is huge because it finally acknowledges the direct link between the seer stone and the treasure digging culture.
A link the church denied for decades. Our sources have the Willard Chase affidavit from 1833 talking about how Joseph used that stone for wonders. And even more, there's the 1825 Articles of Agreement.
A legal document.
A legal document proving Joseph Smith Jr. and Sr. were professional treasure diggers, contracted to get 2/11 of any fines.
And here's the absolute killer detail for the traditional story, the 1826 trial.
Mm-hmm.
The CES letter highlights that Joseph was arrested and brought to court in Bainbridge, New York in 1826 and legally labeled an imposter for this exact activity. This happens before the Book of Mormon translation even starts.
Yes, Sweat's art forces them to acknowledge the stone, but it conveniently leaves out the part where a court of law convicted him for using it fraudulently.
Which brings us right to point three, the translation method. This is the great visual deception.
Sweat has two key paintings here, Gift and Power of God and Translating with Oliver. Both show Joseph looking into his hat.
And in one painting, the gold plates are covered up. In the other, they aren't even in the room.
Right. Which validates the CES letter claim perfectly. The plates weren't actually used for the translation of the Book of Mormon we have today.
And for you listening, you have to appreciate the visual whiplash here. For 150 years, the art showed Joseph poring over open plates.
Right, maybe with the Urim Thummim spectacles. Now, the accurate image is a man with his face buried in a hat.
And Sweat's own words from our sources are so revealing. He admits the accurate depiction looks odd. He says, it won't communicate what the church wants to communicate.
I mean, that quote tells you everything. It doesn't look like a serious academic prophetic endeavor, and that's why they hid it for so long.
They tried so hard to control the visuals. Another artist, Gary Smith, was told to remove the spectacles, the Urim and Thummim, from a painting because they were too sacred to show.
It's just another way of managing the narrative away from the weirdness of the seer stone.
And then there are the church's own films. From 2016, Days of Harmony.
Oh, this is a great example. Stills were taken on set showing the rock in the hat method, but they were cut from the initial release. They only surfaced 2 years later in 2018.
So even when they had the accurate visuals, their first instinct was still to hide it.
The urge to curate the story was stronger than the urge for transparency.
Okay, final point in this section, point four, and we go even deeper into folk magic. Oliver Cowdery's divining rod.
Sweat's painting, Oliver Cowdery and the Gift of the Rod, actually shows him holding a wishbone-shaped stick, a divining rod.
This validates the claim that the church's origins are just so much more rooted in 19th century superstition than the official story ever admitted.
And what's fascinating is how the scriptures themselves were changed to hide this. The original revelation in the Doctrine and Covenants called Oliver's Gift Working with the Sprout.
Which then got changed to Rod.
And finally, it was changed again to the much more sanitized, biblical-sounding Gift of Aaron.
So the church actively edited its own scripture to hide the folk magic. And now, the art is putting the divining rod right back in Oliver's hand.
It's a remarkable admission, years after the fact.
All right, let's shift from translation to the history of priesthood and conflict.
Point five deals with the priesthood ban on black members. Sweat's painting, The Ordination of Q. Walker Lewis, shows an African-American man receiving the priesthood around 1842 in Joseph Smith's time.
And this is so critical because for decades, the narrative often implied, or at least allowed people to believe, that Joseph Smith started the ban.
Or that it was just a divine mandate from the very beginning. This painting refutes that completely. Q. Walker Lewis was a black man, an abolitionist, who received the priesthood under Joseph.
So the art proves the ban did not start with Joseph Smith.
It was implemented later by Brigham Young, and the context is even worse. Brigham Young legalized slavery in Utah right around the time Lewis was there. The art validates the CES letter's core question. How can you trust modern prophets who upheld a racist policy for over a century?
Moving on to point six, a really difficult one, polygamy and threats. The painting is called An Angel with a Drawn Sword.
It shows Joseph kneeling before an angel who is holding a sword, commanding him to practice plural marriage.
And the CES letter called this Warren Jeffs territory.
Because it turns revelation into coercion. The historical sources are clear. Joseph told at least 20 people, including, tragically, the 14-year-old Helen Marr Kimball, that an angel threatened his life if he didn't obey.
Now, Sweat's art is a bit subtle here. The framing is that Joseph would lose his prophetic mantle, not necessarily his life.
Right, it softens the threat, It avoids the explicit loss of life quote that's in so many accounts. But the core fact that polygamy was initiated under divine threat with a sword is now visually confirmed.
And that leads right into point seven, the consequences of that secret practice, the destruction of the Nauvoo expositor.
Sweat depicts men around a bonfire burning papers outside the newspaper office.
The traditional narrative is Joseph as a martyr for his faith, but this painting forces a different story.
A more accurate story. Joseph, acting as the mayor of Nauvoo, ordered the destruction of a printing press. Why? Because that newspaper, published by William Law, was about to expose his secret polygamy.
He violated the First Amendment to silence his critics and hide his private behavior. And that act is what led directly to the criminal charges that put him in Carthage jail.
Exactly. So the art now depicts the burning, forcing that uncomfortable history into the official visual record.
And finally, point eight, the conflict at home. Emma Smith and polygamy. Sweat's painting is titled, tellingly, Purgatory.
It shows a sullen, devastated Emma standing over Joseph, who's holding the revelation on plural marriage, DNC 132.
And this painting just destroys the old narrative of Emma as the perfectly docile, supportive wife.
It has to, because by the time Joseph showed her that revelation in 1843, he had already secretly married at least 19 other women, starting way back in 1835.
So the painting confirms the critic's portrayal of Emma as a victim of years of deception. It brings her pain right into the frame.
It really does.
So those are the eight main points where the art directly validates the CES letter. But you've noted there are other paintings by Sweat that show a similar pattern.
Yeah, if you look at Relief Society Healing, it shows women using priesthood power to heal the sick, a practice that was later banned by Brigham Young, essentially to disempower women.
Or Michael Detecting the Devil, which shows a literal folk magic story for the Doctrine and Covenants, reintroducing the occult elements the church tried to scrub away.
And another one, First Baptisms for the Dead, shows a woman acting as a witness, a practice that was banned, segregated by gender, and then only recently restored in the 2020s.
So the pattern is always the same.
It is. A historical fact is suppressed. The practice is banned. And only decades later, usually after intense outside pressure, is the detail finally acknowledged.
So what's the big takeaway for you, the listener? This art confirms the facts of the CES letter on all these issues. Multiple visions, seer stone, divining rod, the priesthood ban history, the angel with the sword, the expositor, Emma's conflict.
But you have to see the spin. The work is presented as full transparency, but Sweat's own words blaming the audience for being misled by old art or avoiding the harshest parts of the polygamy threats, it shows this is all very carefully managed. It's transparency on a leash.
And that symbolic victory for the critics really drives this home. That aggressive apologetic website that targeted the CES letter, it was recently forced to rebrand.
A huge move. They had to change their name to Study and Faith. It signals they can't aggressively fight the facts anymore. All they can do is retreat to a position of just have faith, which is a major win for historical transparency.
So despite the excommunications, the attacks on Jeremy Reynolds, Grant Palmer, and so many others, the official narrative has been forced to change. The facts they were punished for sharing are now being commissioned into fine art.
And if you want to see the document that started so much of this, the original source material, you should go to sellusletter.org.
So we have to end with a final thought here.
Yeah. Decades ago, a church president, Spencer W. Kimball, he called for art that depicts the struggles and frustrations of the Restoration. And now, finally, they're painting some of those struggles, but only after decades of denial. So we have to ask, if the church is still so carefully selecting which controversial truths from the past are okay to show now, what current policies, what modern struggles are being intentionally left out of the picture today? What is it that future generations will have to fight to have acknowledged?
That is a powerful thought to end on. Thank you for joining us for the Deep Dive. We'll see you next time.